Good morning and welcome to this Tuesday, March 4th. The important thing being the day before ballots are due in the city of Tucson for Prop 411. And you are listening to The Morning Voice. And I am Ted Maxwell, your host today. I've got Matt Neely behind the glass. He'll keep me on time and on target. We've got a full and busy day today. We'll have the Tucson Airport Authority on with us in about 15 minutes to talk a little bit about how they are handling the situation out there and what the latest and greatest at going on at TIA is. At the bottom of the hour, State Senator Vince Leach will come on to give us some updates. We're going to talk particularly about a bill that he's been running for many of us down here in Southern Arizona that we think could help impact and help us with the homeless situation on the streets. And then at 8 o'clock hour, when we start the engagement hour, we'll have David McCumber, the executive editor for the Arizona Daily Star. And we'll talk about his journey, how he got engaged, how he got involved. And yeah, you know, we'll probably talk a little 414 throughout the day. So Matt, 30-0 for Pima Community College.
Can you believe that?
That's just an incredible record. It's an incredible season. I was talking with a friend of mine who coached high school or youth basketball in the day growing up on some of the club teams. And you know what we both recognized and talked about was Brian Peabody. He's the coach out of Pima Community College. He's a local coaching legend in basketball. There's so many players that have gone on to do things at the college ranks and other that Brian Peabody's had his fingerprints on.
Yeah.
And he's done great at the high school level, the club level. He's done, and now 30-0, you can't do much better than that.
That is fantastic. And I believe one of their players, last name is Marley, M-A-J-R-L-E.
We were talking about that as well. I mean, he's not a Thunder Dan, but he's a pretty dang good
solid
player.
Solid contributor. And I know Jim Rosborough used to do some work with them as an assistant.
Yeah,
I believe.
Absolutely.
I don't think he was the coach, but I think he did, you know, he could impart a heck of a lot of wisdom. So, I mean, the recent legacy of that program over the last 10 years, they've really had some high marks.
There's so much that we talk about in Pima Community College and the role it plays in the
yes.
community, especially in training and giving people the skills to either go on and get a 4-year degree or to get, you know, immediately into job and work and have the trades and the skills, the certifications ready to go. We don't talk about their athletics often, but they have quite a historic success. And this basketball 30, you know, I mean, the women's softball's been exceptional out of PCC. The track program has been phenomenal. They've got some great opportunities. And the most important thing, it's giving the young men and women that go to PCC the opportunity to do things they love, but it's also to continue to further their education. And and there's zero doubt that the proof is in the pudding on lifetime earnings. Every degree you get or every certification you get after high school, it's a significant increase over the course of your lifetime when you find your job and your passion.
I can just remember my dad, to me, to other young people, to his grandchildren, the more you learn, the more you earn, right? That's the old adage.
It is.
I can hear him saying it right now.
Yeah, I mean, and the key part of that is at some point you have to go to earn. You just can't learn and learn and learn and learn and learn. You've eventually got to turn it into something in the community. Yeah, you got to get engaged and make that happen. So, well, there's one last step for PCC. Let's see if they can run the entire season.
Yeah.
They've got to now play in the National Junior College Tournament and see how far they can go. And it will be quite an experience, I'm sure, for everybody on the team. One they're going to remember for their life.
Yeah.
And everybody involved. So thanks for sharing that story at the top of the hour. The other one you shared, Matt, was today.
Yes.
Some people could say maybe even tomorrow is the last day you can submit your ballot if you live in the city of Tucson for
414. If you're going to drop it in the mail, it's got to go in the mail today.
And it's important that people remember, if you don't drop it in the mail today, don't throw it away and think you're going to get one when you go to the polls, because the polls aren't the polls.
That's a great point. And I just brought up, I mean, there's a number of places where you can, there's four places where you can drop it off between now and election day. But again, as you said, you are not going to be voting a ballot. You're going to be dropping off your ballot. And if you want to vote your ballot at the polls on election day, and there's one, two, three, four, five, there's six places, and plus the original four that I told you about, you can fill it in there on election day, but it is still the ballot that they mailed you.
Yeah, it's
period.
It's the second step on that one is bring your vote by mail right. ballot, cast the ballot in person, and drop it in the ballot box. So it is not something that you can go in and say, hey, I'm here, I'm a registered voter, mm-hmm. I want to get a ballot. Right. So it's important to remember that. Things have heated up in that space. I think people are getting a little bit more advertising. Yeah. You're hearing more on the radio. You're hearing more on TV. There's definitely campaigns on both sides working it. And it's easy to say that some of the conversations have gotten a little bit more viral. But what I want to talk about is this morning, for those of you who aren't regular Arizona Daily Star readers, and it's kind of a lead-in since David McCumber, the editor, the executive editor of the Daily Star, will be on with us 8 o'clock. This morning, there was an op-ed that was published, and it was written by Kevin Galluli, who is a 55-year resident of Tucson and a retired TPD lieutenant. And his take was, more sales tax money won't fix public safety. And the heart of it, I'm going to read a little bit of it, because I thought he did a really good job of saying what a lot of those who've been saying for the last 4 or 5 years, even in this studio, what do we have to do to improve our public safety? And it really does come down, in my opinion, to the personnel. Chief Casmar, I believe, is the right guy to lead Tucson Police Department. I really believe he's got the right focus. But the challenge is he doesn't have enough sworn police officers. And I know we've heard that said a lot, but let me read a little of this to you. Lieutenant Galluli says, we've kicked the can down the road for far too long. It's barely recognizable today. The city of Tucson has neglected its police department, leaving it understaffed and underfunded. Chief Casmar has said that 90% of the police budget goes to salaries and benefits with only 750 officers currently serving. That's down from 1,100 a few years ago. That's a great point. 90% is still going to nothing but salaries, but they're down to 750 officers when they were at 1,100 just a few years ago. Lieutenant Galluli kind of explains that. He says the Great Recession, worsened by the mortgage crisis, led to austerity measures under city manager Michael Ortega, including forced attrition, buyouts, and hiring freezes. And these cuts reduced the police force to its current state, unable to adequately serve the city. Chief Casmar's focus should be on rebuilding the force to meet established international chief of police standards. That's officers per 1,000 residents, not purchasing aircraft. Tucson's streets are less safe. Fatalities are up and traffic citations are down. In a city with a population of 324,000 residents, the city had no less ever than 24 motorcycle officers, who are the ones who are primarily out there patrolling the streets. By 2022, so 30 years later, with now 541, so 324 thousand. There was never less than 24 motorcycle officers. Now we're up to 541, and that number's dropped to 20 motorcycle officers. Merging public safety air operations with the sheriff's department could be a smarter alternative for our million-plus value population. Mayor Romero actually said as one of her pros on this was that on a Bill Buckmaster show is that, hey, we've already got this. We've got air operations. But we've only got, we borrow the counties once a week or once in a while or when we need it. Mm. But the question is, does both the county, and we've talked about this for long before Prop 414, does the county and the city both need air operations? Can they not both share a single plane? Can they not make better use of helicopter service, using their helicopters together jointly? SALC and a lot of organizations are real big regional folks. We believe that regionality, I mean, the RTA PAG and the RTA Regional Transportation Authority, those are really the best examples if we got regionality. We say we got regional wastewater, but it's really fashioned by the county. Moran has gone off on their own. The city of Tucson even talked about trying to get a grant to do their own wastewater treatment.
Okay.
So that's not really regional anymore. And then the other one is that we claim is regionally managed is water through Tucson Water. The CAP water back in the, I believe, 72 when the agreement was made, the city was going to take all the fresh water from CAP and ensure, and this is air quotes, there would be water mountain range to mountain range. Mm. Well, now if you don't live in the city, you pay a different rate for water than you do if you live in the city. So that's not really even being managed regionally. But I think to have the high-priced, expensive assets that, yes, police and safety need, the city and the county could work together. So let me continue a little bit more. Bottom line, I'll stop with this line that Lieutenant Glooley plays out before he gets into more details of how it can be done, is the city council mayor must prioritize funding personnel over expensive technologies and planes, which have failed to improve safety. The bottom line, he gives in the article, if you go to the Star, you can read it, he gives a couple options for how to do it, but he doesn't think taxing on this, particularly with the sales tax, is the right way to do it. And I fully agree. When we get to this, the only thing that will improve our response times will be more officers on the street. And we
makes more sense to me.
You've heard that here. You've heard it on the Wake Up Tucson proceeding to us. You've heard it, you know, on Buckmaster. So you hear it everywhere. If there's not enough uniformed officers to do the job, then we're going to have continued increases in fatal traffic accidents, in pedestrian deaths. Cause you've got to have folks out there. It's not that you can't trust the community to do what's right, but you know what? When you know nobody's watching, every once in a while you might push that yellow light, you might push the red light.
Yeah, Ted, yesterday afternoon, I saw a video from some business owner. It looked like a coffee place or a restaurant. They had an outdoor patio, and people came and swiped. They had six or seven of those big space heaters that they use to warm up the area, and some of their furniture that they have on their patio. And the lady's like, why am I bothering investing in my business when people just come and pilfer it?
Yeah, we've got a lot of challenges. The business community's pretty been strong advocates opposed to 414. But it's not because we're opposed to public safety. We believe that we need to support the police officers and give them the adequate personnel and resources to do their job right. So at this point, we're going to take a break. When we come back, hopefully we'll have Austin Wright from the Tucson Airport Authority on the line.
Yep.
Good. He's ready to go.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little of what's going on at TIA. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, local trusted news and talk, and we'll be right back.
A little Springsteen today for Ted.
There you go. Welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. I am Ted Maxwell.
Trains to planes.
We're going trains to planes. We're going to play a little. I told Matt I needed a little Bruce to pick me up through all this times. And so we got some you're going to recognize, and we got some you may not recognize. But for me, he always has a way of bringing my day up. So I'm glad Matt's doing that. Right now, we're going to be joined by Austin Wright, the Chief Communications Officer with Tucson Airport Authority. Austin, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for having us always.
Well, I'm really excited to tell you that I'm flying out of Tucson this weekend on my way to Florida for a little R&R and visiting some good friends. But every chance we get, we need to really encourage everybody to fly Tucson first.
That's really the message, and that's what I'm here to talk about, and we're excited to share, too, today that Frontier Airlines started yesterday afternoon, which really brings a different type of travel experience to our community, which we're excited to talk about this morning.
Yeah, so can you tell us a little bit more about Frontier coming in?
Well, what makes it unique is they're an ultra-low-cost carrier. I'm sure people are familiar with their model and their structure, but for a long time, we've really sold the airport as an upscale boutique experience, and this really makes our airport more accessible to the entire Southern Arizona community because it makes flying, I think, financially within reach for someone that may have driven up to Phoenix or just not flown at all. So we're really excited to have an ultra-low-cost option. They started with three flights a week to Denver, and then on May 22nd, they'll add in another nonstop, so they'll also go to Las Vegas. Both those cities are big connecting cities for them, too, so if you have to make a connection on their network, Denver and Vegas are great cities to do that.
Now, I also heard that they may start some flights to Sacramento as well. Is that the case?
So we have Sacramento flights on Alaska Airlines and Southwest Airlines. Frontier hasn't told us their next destinations yet, but they're keeping us on edge because they seem very eager to expand out of Tucson. It seems like these first two cities are just the start for them. They want to continue to grow and invest in Southern Arizona. So we're really excited. They haven't announced Sacramento yet, but please, if your travel or your life calls for anything in Sacramento, use the Tucson Airport. we have to make sure that we fill the seats both on Southwest and Alaska. That's how we keep these new nonstop flights we get.
And I think that's an important message that's worth reiterating, because I remember when we brought in American trying to get, you know, direct to New York, and there's a lot of issues around that. But the fact of the matter comes down, it's about ridership.
100%. And I think a lot of people don't realize this, because we have not had a ton of new actual nonstop destinations, but we've had a ton of capacity gain, which means we have bigger aircrafts, more flight times, more seats. We actually have all the West Coast airports. Tucson had the highest year-over-year capacity gains from November to November of 2024. We had about 16% growth. The average is under 10%. So things are really looking up at the Tucson airport, and things are a real positive for us. But please, when you do fly, we know for a long time it's been a habit to drive, you know, 2 hours up north and go to Phoenix and have a mega airport. Our airport is easy to use. It can get you where you need to go, but it really helps the community when you fly local. So we hope that that resonates with Tucson and people to fly out of our airport.
And Austin, the last time Danette Bewley, your boss, was on the show with me, she really emphasized always start at TUS. You have to start looking there. Even if you decide at some point to go up to Phoenix Sky Harbor and fly out of Phoenix because of convenience, maybe price, whatever your decision is, always take a look online at Tucson, because the airlines track that. They track what airports are searched for flights that ultimately the flyer decides not to use, either due to, you know, lack of availability, lack of convenience. But it plays into that continued support from the airlines for our airport.
Yeah, and I think also another point to add to that is, I think a lot of people are always surprised too when they do check Tucson first, the difference in fare. Oftentimes, if you're going on an international market, going to Europe, Australia, Asia, it's actually significantly cheaper to fly out of Tucson. And for domestic routes, the average fare difference between Tucson and Phoenix is only $54. So I think people are always shocked by how affordable the airport really is to use. And if you're parking at the airport, you're going to make that $50 up quickly compared to parking at Phoenix.
Yeah, you read my mind on that one, that is the case, not to mention you've got the drive in and out. And I won't tell people to take a chance, but you can get through security and get on your flight a lot quicker as well at Tucson than you could up at Phoenix.
A lot quicker. That's, you know, it's just the real ease of our experience. And we're really lucky because we've got an easy airport to use. It's beautiful. But the TSA is one of those real selling points for us, because what may take an hour and a half in Phoenix, well, you know, of course we can't guarantee this, but it should take you less than 15 minutes on a good day to get through security in Tucson. It's a quick, seamless experience.
Yeah, and I would say that's especially true if you don't have like Tucson pre-check, or if you don't have Clear, you don't know anything. It's just more convenient. And it's supporting your local airport, which is going to support the local economy. Now, we've got about two more minutes left, but you talked about how our capacity had significantly increased. And I know that some of that was driven with the immigration flow that was going on at the time, and the need to get those folks who had come into the country to their sponsors. And so there was a lot of flights being driven by that. But now that that's stopped, how important is it for us to continue to support the airport to keep that kind of access?
Yeah, I mean, being totally transparent, the migrant travel at Tucson in terms of outbound travel, so people using our airport for a one-way basis just to leave, accounted for about 10% of our overall passenger traffic last year. So this year, we are seeing zero migrant travelers at the airport, which means we're facing about a 10% headwind on outbound travel. Now, with that said, we are doing a lot of marketing throughout Southern Arizona to try to capture people's attention and inspire travel to fill those seats. Because like we talked about earlier in this broadcast, you've got to use those seats to retain them, or they will reallocate them where there's strong demand. And I'm happy to report that we've seen really positive response from the community, that our community is showing up, they're flying, they're standing behind the airport. And we feel like we're in a pretty good position to retain a significant portion of the capacity that we got.
So, Austin, we've got about 40 seconds left before we have to go to break. Anything that you want to add in closing thoughts?
You know, we are always hard at work to continue to expand our network. We hear the community that there is a real desire for Mexico flights, for Canada flights, for eastbound flights to New York, to Florida. That is all very much on our radar. We just met with 16 airlines last month. So we're out on the road. We try every day to pitch Tucson. We feel we've got a great business case, and we're doing everything we can to continue to grow the airport for this community.
Well, that's great news. Talking to 16 different airlines about it, we've got opportunities here. So I encourage everybody to fly Tucson first. Make sure you're checking the prices. You may be surprised. So, Austin, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
And absolutely.
And please give my best to Danette, and we'll look forward to the next time she joins us for a quick update.
Absolutely. Thanks. Have a great day.
Absolutely. You've been listening to Austin Wright from the Tucson Airport Authority, and this is 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back with Senator Vince Leach.
From the music business after Born to Run, he's having some issues with the record company, and he came back pretty strong with Darkness on the Edge of Town.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. It's this is all high school throwbacks. I told Matt he's got to be careful, because one of these days you're going to catch me singing on the mic, and that will not be a good thing for any of you. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. And now I'm honored to welcome Senator Vince Leach, LD-17. Like I like to say on these things, is he's my senator, so he's back. Appreciate Senator Leach, you joining us?
Good to be here. That is some lead-in music that you had. I was wondering if I had the right station or the right number when I called in.
No offense, Senator, but you know, I'm not sure Matt and I could have gotten away between the two of us on the other sides of the glass and enjoying that lead-in. It was good, but no, you've got the right you've got the right station, and I appreciate you joining us again for this half hour. First off, Senator Leach, as is representative of LD-17, he was a representative in LD-11. He's served 4 years as a member of the state house and then transitioned over to the state senate for 4 more years. He took a 2-year pause, and you've come back with a lot of gusto coming back into the state senate this year. And how are you finding after that 2 years away? Have things changed at all? Is it a different environment? What are you seeing for how you're having to work inside the Senate now?
Well, there's an old saying that you can't go home, and to some degree that is true. The process is the same. You go to committee, your bill goes to caucus, goes to the committee of the whole, and then you vote on it. So all the mechanics are the same, but what is different is the people that make it up. There's always a chemistry that forms within the Senate and for that matter in the House. I don't want to say it's bad. It's just there's a chemistry there, and you've got to. And that chemistry for me has changed. I don't say that's a bad thing. It's just that it takes a little while to get back in for the people that you don't know. I mean, there are several senators that I've not worked with. There's many House members that I've not worked with. So from that standpoint, that's different. The other thing that's different is that I'm not in leadership. Some would say that's a good thing. But by not being in leadership, you know, there's some leadership things that you have to do because you're representing basically the whole caucus, where I'm not in leadership now, so I have more freedom to maybe do and particularly say what I wanted to say.
Yes, Senator, we've talked about that historically. For full disclosure, I've worked with you on several issues. Some we've worked together, and occasionally we've been on the opposite side of the aisles. But your service in the North Oro Valley, Pinal County, and now stretches all the way down to Vail. You've made some adjustments from the difference of the old LD-11 to LD-17.
Certainly, you have to. You're elected by the people. When you stretch from Saddlebrook Ranch in the north, Picture Rocks to the east, and then you come up back west through Oro Valley, Marana, go up the mountain, and then make a hard right and come down through Tango Verde Valley and Vail, you have, I think there's like 275,000 people in there, about 168,000 voters. But certainly Vail, in its growth and the way they're building schools versus a Saddlebrook and a Saddlebrook Ranch. You just have two different constituencies, and woe on to somebody that doesn't recognize that. One size does not fit all, and sometimes that's difficult as a representative of the people, as a senator, that you take a position on a bill that goes very good, let's say, with Vail, but it doesn't really necessarily serve the people in Saddlebrook Ranch.
Well, you're
it's walking the tightrope. Walking the tightrope.
And that's the way the system is set up to do. It's not just that. I think the tightrope, as you mentioned a moment ago, is you have to represent everybody in the district, and sometimes people forget that. Not everybody in the district, even amongst the same party on either side, agree with some of the actions being taken. There's a lot of diversity. I think you've managed to thread that needle in your first couple months back in the Senate, and look forward to you continue to do that into the future.
Yeah, well, this is the time when you have to rely on your abilities to get things across the finish line. I know we're going to talk about a couple of bills this morning it's important that we get these across the finish line, but you have to, not everybody's with you necessarily at the beginning of the bill, and by the time you get to the last committee and then go on to the caucus and the committee of the whole, and then ultimately to vote on it, we need 16 votes, and 16 votes here and 31 votes over in the House to get anything passed or said to the governor. And that's where the time is spent now, developing not only the relationships, but developing the reasons why what I'm presenting is a good bill, not only for LD-17, not only for Vail, not only for Saddlebrook Ranch, Eagle Crest, but it's also good for Lake Havasu. It's also good for Flag. It's also good for Sholo. That's what we do.
That's right, Senator. And I'm going to throw in, it's also good for the city of Tucson. And I want to talk about a bill that several folks from this region have been working with you on crafting that's actually looks like it's got some legs. Despite a lot of people thinking it was going to be a tough bill to get through. Last year, a similar bill, but with a few more rough edges, was run by your predecessor. It didn't get traction, but we have it moving. That's SB 1257, and it deals with involuntary separation. You want to talk a little bit about that bill and set the table, and then we can talk a little bit more in depth where it's sitting?
Yeah, it's first of all, I want to say hats off to everybody that's worked on this bill. Tucson Crime Coalition was the leader of it. I think people started talking to me from that organization early, man, it might have been even November when I was first approached. And hats off to Josh and Kevin. And certainly you, as part of that coalition. We've had many meetings. But it was a coalition that came forward, and we all recognize that we have a drug problem on the streets. We have vandalism as a result of that. And several things have been tried. Right now we have what I refer to as a two-day revolving door where people get picked up, they come in, we can only hold people for 2 days, they spin around and they go out. And we're paying for that. We're paying access. Our Medicaid is for the most part, it pays for that. Well, the Tucson Crime Coalition came forward with a bill, and it is court-ordered, I stress that, court-ordered placement of stabilization, a process to get the person that's on on these drugs to get the drugs cleared out so that they're back to where they can make decisions and they can make decisions for themselves. The problem with 2 days is it takes longer than that. We had testimony in committee that it takes about 5 days for meth to clear your system, and that's what this court-ordered stabilization time period is. Contrary to the headlines, we're not locking people up. You have to go through, first of all, number one, it has to be court-ordered. But when you read the bill and the things that have to be checked off before this person is put into court-ordered stabilization is long, is tedious, but it's all in protection of the person that's being brought in. And I think that's key. I think that's key to the people listening, that this isn't akin to what you might have heard some time ago about red flag laws, where I can say, you, Ted, we're going to put you in for treatment. It's not that. This has to go before a judge. It has to be adjudicated. And then we go through the process. And at any time, the person involved can say, no, I don't want to do this. But that's the mission. Our people in the Tucson Crime Coalition, and Ted, I know you're probably closer to the numbers than I am. I mean, doors are being smashed, urination, sexual acts in front of businesses. This is all in an effort to stop this, to get control of it. And it is, and this is a key point, it is voluntary at the county base. So if some counties don't want to participate in this program, they don't have to participate. It's all voluntary. I think that's a key point. I'll take a breath and let you
know. No, Senator, you're doing a great job selling the good aspects of it. It's really important. Yes, the Tucson Crime Free Coalition was involved in it, but we've got to make sure that people also know that the county, Pima County, is behind the Sylvia Lee, former board supervisor, was working on it. They've had some of their medical folks involved. They actually helped craft the original language, which is the most important thing I want people to understand, is this has bipartisan support. The Tucson Crime Free Coalition, a lot of people look at it and go, oh, it's just the right wing. It's not. The Tucson Crime Free Coalition has a lot of Republicans, Democrats, independents, and party not declared members. And it was real ironic, because in the first hearing I wanted to give you kudos on, you were, I won't say attacked, but you were questioned really hard about the fact that one of the Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee said, we've got lots of great ideas as Democrats, we just never get the hearings. How can we have input? You know, this is, and meanwhile, you've got one of the speakers from the Tucson Crime Free Coalition who came up. I spoke that day as well. You know, he's sitting there going, ma'am, I'm a Democrat. And then I thought your response was incredible. You looked to her very respectfully, called her by name, and said, I've only got one thing to say. And then you gave her your cell phone number and said, call me. We're going to work. And the fact of the matter is, the original bill has morphed and has continued to get more input from all the detractors, because you are willing to work to get this done. I want everybody to understand what it really does is, right now, after 23 hours, 59 minutes, and 59 seconds, we have to release anybody we hold under Title 36, unless they have severe mental illness. This allows us to be able to demonstrate continued influence from those narcotics, and you can hold them no more than 5 days to let that clear. The truth is, it takes that long to clear, and once they clear, then their brains hopefully are in a position that they can make a more logical decision on their future. It doesn't take their rights away in any way, shape, or form.
Ted, I think that the bipartisan approach, from a political standpoint, from where we are and where the bill is going through the process, has been helpful. We came, we have 10 members on appropriations, and it came out 8-2.
That's impressive. That's impressive.
Yes, because it came right through appropriations, because there will be money involved in it. But that particular senator that I gave my phone number to also also sits on appropriations, and I was kind. I didn't say anything, but she didn't call me. She didn't call me in the week in between, which, anyway, it is what it is, and that's part of the political scene. But I go to caucus in the morning here in about an hour and a half. This bill will be in caucus. It'll be discussed amongst all the Republicans, and then hopefully we'll have a vote on this bill Wednesday. Hopefully by Thursday we should have a vote in the Senate. I hear the music playing.
Outstanding, Senator. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, I'm going to let you pick between those three other topics we were going to cover, because we definitely went down that rabbit hole. But I appreciate your leadership on this. It's important to Southern Arizona. That's the voice of Vince Leach, State Senator representing LD-17. And you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely behind the glasses, keeping us on time and target, which is going to be tough this time because this is a real short one. I've got Senator Vince Leach with me, representing LD-17. Senator, we really covered a lot that first go, so I'm going to let you pick. You had three different things: Axon, illegal vaping, and third-party funding for lawsuits. Which one of those do you want to talk about?
Well, I really want to talk about all three, but I know we have a time factor, so I'm going to talk about Senate Bill 1272, and that's illegal vape products here in Arizona and indeed across the country. We have this has stirred up a lot in the public. I can tell by the number of phone calls and emails, and thank you for sending your emails and your thoughts in on this particular bill. I want to talk about it because we actually have a flood of illegal products coming in from China. They are mismarked coming through the ports of entry. They are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration in Washington, D.C. They may say that they're on the test, that they're testing them, but that they'll never be approved. We know that the amount of nicotine in these illegal products, and by the way, this is not a Phoenix problem. This is a state problem. One of the distributors for the product has 47 stores across the state, and we have 11 stores in the Tucson area. I would highly suggest that you go into one of these stores and you look. It is wall to wall with illegal products. How does it happen? As I said, it comes across the border, mismarked. It gets into the chain, the supply chain, and that's how it gets here. It hasn't gone through the testing. We don't know. We can't tell. One of our jobs in government is to protect the people. We don't know any bad actors in it, what's in it. We have done some limited testing that's out there, and there's some really, really bad actors in this vape. We also know that while they publish a 5% nicotine level, that we've seen it as high as 15 and 17%, which people, you know, when you read it, you think that you're getting a low level dose of nicotine.
Well Senator, go ahead. Senator, we are up against it. What this means is you're going to have to come back. But appreciate your work on this one. Appreciate all your work there, and thank you for your service. And everybody, that was Vince Leach. Good morning and welcome back. Well, I know that I'm not going to buy a box of scorpion lollipops for Matt Neely the next time I need to get him a gift, but
not going there.
We'll see where you go with that. So you are listening.
Acquired taste.
Absolutely. One that I have not tried yet. And after that description, I'm not sure I'm going to. So we won't see that. We'll see where that goes. You are listening to The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, your host, and that is Matt Neely behind the glass. So the second hour of my show is, we like to refer to as, the engagement hour. And that purpose is to encourage all of you to get informed, get engaged, get involved, and be heard. We have rights and responsibilities as we are a nation bound by shared values of freedom, liberty, and equality. And with that comes those rights and those responsibilities to get involved. For some, that includes service to our country and others' service to our community. We've talked a lot on the engagement about the various different roles, and one of the important roles that has a lot more influence, and I think we recognize it, we just don't always like to talk about it, is the media and the print and online and the television. So today I'm very glad to have David McCumber with me today. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, Ted. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to this conversation for a lot of different reasons. And David's the executive director, or sorry, the executive editor at the Arizona Daily Star. And on top of it, he's written four nonfiction books. And I think we may have some time to get in and talk about those. But David, part of the engagement hours, I like people to kind of hear other folks who are engaged and involved, their kind of journey. So what got you into the news media in the first place?
Wow. I always kind of wanted to, at that time, sit in front of a typewriter for a living.
Okay, now we're going back.
That's correct. I was 16 years old when I got my first job in newspapers, and it went from there. Other than going and serving in the Navy during the Vietnam era, I've been in the newspaper business pretty much consistently for 55 years, with a little break for writing a few books in between.
So I can't let that Navy comment go. So what did you do in your service in the Navy?
A lot of people carried my weight. I was a journalist.
Okay.
I was I'd already had a couple of years newspaper experience, and so they sent me to the Forest Service Journalism School, and that's what I ended up doing.
Well, as a journalist in Vietnam time frame, or in that era, or in any era even now, there's really an important role that plays during times of conflict. So yeah. Thank you for your service. Sometimes I guess Good Morning Vietnam kind of made being a either a radio or a journalist showed the role it can play, and it's important. So I want to thank you for your service and appreciate you doing that. So I, talking with you and going through things, I said you got your start in San Francisco, and that's not really true. You got your start in smaller outlets.
Yeah, I went to work at the Scotts Bluff Star Herald when I was 16. I worked at several small newspapers. I worked in northern New Mexico, in Raton, Los Alamos, Farmington. And I loved that country. Went away to the Navy and came back to Raton as the editor, and went and ended up going down to El Paso, going to work at the El Paso Herald Post for Scripps Howard. The paper no longer exists, which is just one more sign of my antiquity. And then came to Tucson, Arizona in 1978 to work at the Arizona Daily Star. And worked. This is my third tour of duty at the Star now. So I worked. In Tucson for a couple of years, then went to Austin, Texas, and worked for a year at the American Statesman, and then back to Tucson, and then off to the San Francisco Examiner. I was city editor and assistant managing editor there, and went and worked as the editor of the paper in Santa Barbara, California, for a while. I got talked back into the newspaper business to go work at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, and I ended up being the editor there for about 9 years. Went to the East, which I had resolutely avoided for my whole career, and went back there, ran a group of newspapers in Connecticut briefly, and then 3 years, I think, and then was Hearst Newspapers Washington bureau chief for several years before moving to Montana and working for my current employer, Lee Enterprises, as editor of a small paper in Butte, Montana, and then began to take on larger responsibilities with them. Became a regional news executive with them, which I did for several years before coming here.
So I'm going to jump into the books first, because what I've decided is there's several issues from what you've experienced since you've come back to Tucson. So
sure.
We'll get at that at the next break. You did all those things. mean, I know you've had a long distinguished career. You've been part of Pulitzer Prize winning efforts. You've been, nominated for Pulitzer Prizes. You've been actually worked for Pulitzer for a while and sat on some of their selection boards. So you've got a lot of there. How did you ever find the time to write nonfiction books?
Well, you know, it was a kind of an odd occurrence, but I was the editor, as I mentioned, in Santa Barbara, and I got a call from a publisher in New York who wanted to hire me to write a book. And it doesn't happen very often, but I was 39 years old. Somebody offered me a pretty nice book contract, Simon & Schuster, and I thought, if I don't take this, I'm going to kick myself in the butt the rest of my days. And so I hired an agent who was terrific and got the offer greatly increased, and it was enough money that I could actually contemplate, jumping from a pretty secure job at the New York Times Company and, you know, benefits and all that to, you know, paying for my own health insurance and being an entrepreneur and going to work writing a book. Wrote that one. Did okay.
So should we talk about that one? That's kind of the steamy one a little bit, I think.
It's a true crime. It's a San Francisco story, and it was two brothers who were pornographers and made a name for themselves in that dubious profession. And, you know, basically from the summer of love forward. And one of them was a pretty much a straight arrow businessman, and the other one had every vice you could imagine, and many that I probably shouldn't discuss on the radio.
Well, we won't.
And
we won't.
The caretaker brother got tired of it and shot the other brother to death.
And that's kind of interesting, the twist. The caretaker was the one that did it.
Yeah.
And the reason I just brought that one up is because that, to me, is a good example of kind of I won't say the themes, because you kind of, your four books are kind of all over the place. But writing a nonfiction to me seems difficult because it's factual. You've got to do your research.
Got to do the reporting.
Yep. And so it really is an advent from your news work beforehand. Yeah. Now, David's written three books, and that one that we talked about was published in 92. In 96, one that's got my attention, Playing Off the Rail. It's about a pool hustler. You actually funded and traveled with a pool.
I met a guy in San Francisco when I was doing research for the first book, who was a second-generation Italian, a native San Franciscan, and he was everything you don't associate with being a pool hustler. He was an excellent businessman. He was, didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't do drugs, macrobiotic eater, student of martial arts. You ask him about his aiming technique on the table, and he would start talking to you about Cartesian theory of symmetry. And it was just really an interesting character. And
the book's more exciting than that, though, right?
Yeah, well, the whole point was I knew I was going to run into the stereotypical pool player on the road. And the great thing was that this guy had a larcenous heart. He was definitely, he had the instincts of a predator. And so
looking for that perfect hustle, I think was the quote I read in one of the things.
Yeah. And so I took him on the road, staked him to play, and we played high dollar pool all over the country and ran into those great pool characters. And I love exploring subcultures. And, that's what this was. I found that the world of gambling and pool is remarkably unchanged since the days hustlers went around on the train.
So,
and so that's that was the interest to me.
Yeah. I now are these all available also on audio?
They're not. I wish they were.
We need to fix that, because I'm an audio guy.
I am too.
So you just said subcultures. So your next book was a true adventure into subculture. Describe it really quick?
I've lived in the West my whole life, and I've always been curious about what the real life of a cowboy was. We all know the Hollywood version, but I wanted to know what it was really like. And so I hired out on a 100,000 acre cattle ranch in central Montana.
Did you have any experience?
Absolutely not. it was very funny because I had a hard time getting the rancher's attention. I knew where I wanted to work because this ranch, the ground had great history. The family is an amazing family. It was a lot to tell there, I knew. And so I was trying to talk this guy into hiring me. And, I had a hard time getting his attention. When I finally met with him, he said, "What do you know about ranch work?" And I said, "I don't know. I'll use the word beans here." and he said, "Well, glad you said that. I knew it already." And so that kind of irritated me just a little bit, you know, but I let it go. And I said, "Okay." And he said, "You're not one of those tree huggers, are you?" And so, you know, now my nose is about half out of joint. And I said, "Yeah, I got a few splinters in my chest and I'm proud of it, you know." And he said, "Well, guess what? So am I." He said, "You look around this place, I use as few chemicals as I possibly can. I treat the ground right. You won't see it skinned." He said, "I do that because it's my family heritage and it's my paycheck, and I don't need any scientists from the state telling me how to do it." And I thought, you know, I might like this guy. I might be able to make this work. And so I said, "When do I start?" And he said, 7:00 tomorrow. If you don't work out as a hand, you're down the road. And so that was an amazing year.
And you made it through all four seasons. That book's The Cowboy Way, Seasons of a Montana Ranch. The final book, which we won't get into because I do want to get to the point of talking to you, was one called An Air That Kills. And it was a story literally about a town that this, I think, really leaned on your investigative reporter.
Much more journalistic and less stunt journalism as the last two were. But yeah, it was much more of a journalistic project. It came out of an investigative project that we did in Seattle.
Right. And that one you actually co-authored with another.
I did, with a great investigative reporter.
Right. So that's the voice of David McCumber, the executive editor of the Arizona Daily Star. And I think that fills in a lot of the background of who you are, what you did, and kind of how you've leveraged the talents that you have and you've had since 16 years old. So when we come back, we'll talk about what brought you to the Arizona Daily Star and some of the challenges that you've faced since you've been here, including one very recently. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk, and we'll be right back with David. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. And my guest this morning during the engagement hour is David McCumber, the executive editor for the Arizona Daily Star. And as we pointed out, the author of four fascinating nonfiction books. Every year, my wife and I set a goal for the number of books we're going to read. And she's like, goes to like 12, 14, something ridiculous. I'm just hoping to get through four. Well, I've got a couple more that I'm looking at pulling up and reading because they're intriguing. I love nonfiction. I really do. I love learning something about either people, places. And I think that went through in the story of your books. But more important to me, it tells me a lot more about you. And so I appreciate you sharing that with us this morning. But bottom line is, you're now the executive editor of the Arizona Daily Star, a paper that some will give a lot of acclaim to in the region and some will bash. So welcome to the world of the Tucson Swirly. And what brought you back?
Well, you know, I happen to like being a newspaper editor. And I was, as I mentioned briefly a little earlier, before I came here for this tour, I was a regional executive for Lee. And I was the Western region, and I had 27 newsrooms in 13 states that I was responsible for. And so I was on the road all the time, which I don't mind around the West. But what I didn't necessarily love was that I couldn't feel like I had the engagement with the community, the impact on the community. You know, my goal as an editor of a newspaper is to have a positive impact on a community, on the staff, on the quality of a newspaper, and quality of the news product, however it's delivered. And I didn't feel like I had that as the regional guy who showed up, every once in a while. And I wanted to get back to what I knew better, which was being the editor in a community. And I have a soft spot for Tucson, having lived here before. I love this city, and I have a real soft spot for the Star. I had the pleasure of working with a lot of great people here before and having some journalistic accomplishment here. And I just, I knew that things were a lot different here now. The newspaper business, for the last 25 years, I joke that if you've been in the business over that time, you either have PTSD or survivor's guilt or both. And
no more typewriters.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot fewer journalists. We've seen the brutal calculus of the business just change rapidly. And the fact is, we have a community of a million people plus to cover, and we have a lot fewer people to do it than we used to. And so we have to be strategic, and it's a daily challenge. And that's why I came back, was to take that challenge and to be part of this community again.
Well, I think we've seen some changes since you've come back in the Star. I think it's been recognized that there is an attempt in a broad community to be balanced and give both sides. What do you think the biggest impact that you were able to make when you came back?
Well, I really wanted to harken back to the Star's reputation for doing great journalism. I'm old-fashioned enough to call it fulfilling the public trust. This news business, it is a business, but it's not necessarily like most businesses. People have a vested interest in what we do, and they care passionately about it. Our customers think it's their newspaper, and guess what? They're right. It is. And so that public trust is what motivates me as an editor. So I want to make sure, first of all, that whatever changes we had to make to deal with the economic realities of the business, that we maintained that edge, maintained that ability to do great journalism. On the opinion side, I do put the opinion pages together every day. I personally, and I care about presenting fairness. And it's not always, people will look at our letters and say, well, why do you run such a big percentage of progressive or left-leaning, letters, if you will. Well, first of all, we run what we get. And what I try to do is reflect the views of the hundreds of letters that we get. And a lot of the time, we have to pick and choose. We put a lot more letters online than we get into the print product. But, it's interesting. Right after a campaign, right after, for instance, the 2024 election, it's like falling off a cliff. Suddenly, everybody's written out. Nobody sends me op-eds. Nobody sends me letters. So I was running literally everything I got for a period of about a month. After the inauguration and things started happening in the administration, I'm getting a lot of letters and a lot of op-eds. My best to reflect the tone and tenor of what I get. I think that's my job.
Well, I think that's part of engagement. It's time for people to make sure that you get your letters to the editor. And you can have a pretty high success rate, and you've got a very, very high success rate of being at least published online.
Yes.
Sometimes that's a frustration when you want to see it in print, if you're a print person. But the fact of the matter is you can go to the website. We've got about a minute and 20 seconds. So real quick, you were just hit by a cyber attack.
Oh, boy.
And it impacted things. How have you worked through it differently than Lee? Because I understand Lee's still struggling.
Yeah, this hit the entire company. It was a cyber attack against Lee Enterprises. The first week, I think 65 out of our 77 plus publications didn't publish in print. Which is just an indication of the severity of this. We were not one of them. We printed, and I made sure that we took the steps necessary to publish. I hearken back in a column that I wrote to 1982 here in Tucson when we had a terrible explosion at our plant, and we had no power. And it was said that, well, how can we put a paper out? And we made sure we got a paper out that day. And so I was determined that that record was not going to stop over this. And we have since recovered a little quicker than some of the other papers, because we had the ability to take some of the design work that has been sent elsewhere to do in the name of efficiency. We had the ability to take that back and do it in-house, which has helped us recover.
Well, it's greatly appreciated from those of us who get up every morning before we even get out of bed, call up the online edition of the printed paper and read it in its entirety to get a pulse of what's going on in the region. So that kind of sets the page. We'll talk a little bit about 414 and some of the impact that editorial page has been impacted by because of that over the last couple weeks. That's the voice of David McCumber with Arizona Daily Star, and you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. And this is the Morning Voice. Ted Maxwell, I'm your host. Tomorrow you'll have Grant Kruger. The Morning Voice is the same format as we had in Jump in Tucson. Five different hosts, five different days, five different focuses. There's always something new to listen to if you tune in the morning. And Grant will be back, and I'm sure he will have a good blend of food and politics involved. And Matt, do you know who he's got on tomorrow yet?
I'm drawing a blank, so I don't think I do.
Okay. Well, the one thing about Grant, you know he's going to come fired up, ready to go, and it will be interesting. So I've got David McCumber with me right
Fair
now.
Fair bet there might be some 414 in there.
I'm just saying. We might even get to a little 414
finally,
too. We'll see how we go down. David McCumber, the executive editor with the Arizona Daily Star. I appreciate all the conversation we had in the first half hour, David. It told us a lot about you and about your vision and focus on what the role and responsibilities of the media are.
Well, thank you. It's just great to be here and talk with you.
Oh, I'm enjoying it. So we talked about the cyber attack, and you kept the Star getting printed daily. You didn't miss a day. That's something you took pride in.
That's correct.
And we kept rolling through, and you're in a much better position than some of the other Lee Holdings accounts. And so we finally got back up what many people may not have noticed, but those of us who are the opinion page and the editorial page junkies noticed you had to go to a single page for quite a while.
Yeah. For a couple weeks.
And what challenges did that play for you in this time where here locally we've got 414, absent city sales tax, which we'll talk about a little bit. But we also got a lot of interest on things going on the national front. So having to cut that page down to one.
Yeah, it definitely played a big role. I mean, the first thing that happened was I lost all of my national syndicated, I didn't have the ability to run any national content. The locally produced guest opinions really stacked up because I could only run one a day. I my space for letters is sacrosanct. I have to have want those letters every day, and so we were very limited for a while, and it was difficult. Particularly the thing I was most concerned about was local issues and making sure that we resume the conversation about local issues in an in-depth way with guest opinions as soon as we could. And, again, one of the reasons it was important was the timing of, here people already have their ballots and making decisions on 414, and it's not a time to go silent.
No, it's not. And the Arizona Daily Star decided not to go silent on this one.
Right.
So you actually, I don't know if it's officially under your byline or under the editorial staff, but the Arizona Daily Star took a position on Prop 414. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. We took the position of opposing 414. And it wasn't an easy call because there's nobody that's more concerned about public safety in Tucson than I am. I mean, I commute every day, and I see it's the Wild West out there. I mean, I'm very concerned about road safety. I'm concerned about pedestrian deaths. I'm concerned about I'm concerned about crime. I'm concerned about all of those public safety issues. And you'd think that a proposition that was had its birth in considering public safety would be something that we'd jump on with both feet. But the devil's in the details. And I felt like, first of all, it became a grab bag to try to gather the necessary votes. And there's an awful lot in there. And I just didn't feel like the city made a very compelling case, nearly as compelling as I would have expected. And one of the problems I have is we have a $2.4 billion budget, city budget, annual budget. And, we ran a fine op-ed from the city manager. He complained that's a big number, but we only $750 million a year of it is discretionary. And so, and I know that there is a lot of, mouths to feed, if you will, for that $750 million. But to me, if the public safety concerns were so urgent and so compelling that the city thought they were a top priority, why weren't they being adequately funded out of that $750 million already? And given how much money this would raise, why couldn't they look at finding at least a chunk of that from the existing budget? It just didn't seem. I didn't feel like the city made the case that we've looked and we just don't have the money to do these vital things that we need to do with this enormous budget that we already have. And I just couldn't get past that.
And to your point, this 2.4 is the budget. That's just a fact. Yes, there's 600 that goes to enterprise programs, which the city can't touch, but there's 1.8 billion beyond that. And yes, some of it's obligated, but it's decisions that were made by the mayor and council as they were either applying for grants or going back to the voters, stuff you can't touch. And this is a 10-year budget. One of the big concerns we had is if public safety is the priority, then that should have been the priority. We're not going to fix anything because it's too little spread. And as you pointed out, officers are a big part of it. The reason we've got traffic issues and others is because there hasn't been that focus on giving them raises to be competitive. I know they compare the salaries to the local ones, but there's a big difference between being an officer and what you're dealing with in Oro Valley, Marana, or Sarita versus in the city of Tucson. You go up north to the Phoenix communities that may mirror some of the problems we have, their officers are getting paid a lot more.
That's right.
The city of Phoenix puts 48% of their general fund. Mesa puts 53% of their general fund, whereas Tucson only puts 30% of their general fund towards police.
And I also thought that more of it should go, if you're going to raise this much money in the name of public safety, put that money in the officers' pockets. Don't buy an aircraft with it. I mean, that was something that really stuck in my craw.
Yeah, the op-ed by Lieutenant Galluli this morning, which I referenced earlier, pointed that out. You know, we're down from a high of over almost 1,100 officers, if not higher than that, down to 750 sworn officers, 20 motorcycle officers versus more than 24, yet almost double the population. Manpower is the key. And what we see is what you see on the drive. I travel in this day, and I appreciate that you're willing to talk about it. It's sometimes one of those ones, if you say something, people go, oh, you can't talk bad about our community. We've got issues. We need to fix them. So I appreciate the STAR taking a forward role on that one.
Thank you.
So what's next in the way of the STAR? What coming out of the cyber attack, coming out of this, what are you looking for to change
or
improve?
Well, thanks. I One of the things we're really excited about that we're doing is we're refocusing a lot of effort on community sports. And within the rubric of community sport is prep sports, you know, high school sports. It's Little League to Legion baseball. It's participatory sport. I don't know if you saw the story about the pole vaulting thing this weekend. I just absolutely loved
something I knew nothing about.
And we have this incredibly dynamic young journalist, Elvia Verdugo, and she's Tucsonan. She's born and raised here, and she loves this. She just lives for Tucson sport, and she's doing a fantastic job covering, you know, those stories that weren't being told, I thought, as well as they should. So that's something I'm really, really excited about. We're going to put more effort into.
As a sports fan, I love that, and I know Matt and I hope you might be there tonight, 9 o'clock, when ASU comes into town. We can't let that game go. Yeah. You know, we thought we were going to get better times for the being in the Big 12, but nope, 9 o'clock tip off tonight. But senior night for our Wildcats. And David, I want to thank you for coming on. I love the local focus. I think that's critical. The local focus that people don't know about, like the high school sports. Yep. That's old school journalism right there.
Well, thanks, Ted. Thanks very much for having me.
So appreciate you being with us. I guarantee you'll be getting a call. I'd like to have you back.
And excellent.
Everybody, that's David McCumber, the executive editor of the Arizona Daily Star, and you're listening to 1030 The Voice. We'll be back with Stephen Levine from RJP Estate Planning.
This one originally popped up on the Ruthless People soundtrack. This was from The Last Temptation of Elvis compilations CD.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice. We kind of guess that was a little play on words there for us, Matt, The Morning Voice and The Voice. You know, I'm a little slow on the
Indeed.
Uptake.
Yes, it was.
So that's great. So my question is, do you know what will happen with your estate when you pass away? If you're unsure, you're not alone. And that's why Stephen Levine from RJP Estate Planning is here to explain why failing to protect your estate can become a financial and emotional burden for your loved ones. And Stephen, it's estimated that American families collectively pay over $2 billion in probate court fees and legal costs each year. Thank you for joining us today. And where do these legal court fees come from?
Hey, Ted, good morning. So great question. It unfortunately comes out of the kids' inheritance or your beneficiaries. So studies, including the Gallup, show that nearly two-thirds of Americans do not have a documented estate plan. Many assume that their assets automatically pass to their loved ones when they pass away, but without having a living trust to protect your assets, that is not the case. So instead, your estate could be tied up in probate court for months, years. That's what leads to costly delays, legal fees, obviously the unnecessary stress for surviving family members. That's where the $2 billion loss comes from when you add them all up. So money that should have been going to the surviving family members, but instead gets eaten up by these court fees, attorney costs. And probate isn't just expensive, it's time consuming. So, I mean, you're talking about freezing assets like selling the house. People have to front the load for property tax, mortgage. They can't access your bank accounts to pay for that. So it's coming out of somebody's pocket. Without a living trust to protect your assets, your family could spend months, years dealing with the red tape to settle your estate instead of receiving their inheritance. So Arizona's tricky. So each state's different, but Arizona, if you own a home or have more than $75,000 in personal assets, that includes investments, that meets the low thresholds for a probate settlement in Arizona. But the good news is your estate could avoid probate by simply creating a living trust, and that can be changed or updated anytime while you're alive. So when you pass away, your trust ensures that your assets go directly to the people you love without the court delays, legal fees, and all that stress for the family. So it also keeps your estate private, which is a big deal, because probate's public, and protect your assets from creditors after you pass.
So if someone owns a home or has over the $75,000 in unprotected assets that you mentioned, what could probate cost them in Arizona?
Yeah, great question. So every case is different, but probate fees could easily reach tens of thousands of dollars. We've seen it all the time. And the financial loss is certainly the biggest consequence for your loved ones. It's not the only issue, though. So your family, like I mentioned earlier, can face overwhelming legal process, which, you know, probate's public. So they inventory your assets, the filing court documents, hiring attorneys, all during a time while families are grieving. Even worse, because your bank accounts, like I said, are frozen during this probate period, your loved ones may have to cover the mortgage payments, property taxes, homeowners insurance, all out of their own pockets as they wait for the court to sell your estate. So with having a living trust, all of this is easily avoided. A trust ensures that everything is legally documented, handled privately, and your assets pass seamlessly without any court interference.
So, Stephen, many people believe that having a will is enough to protect their assets, but will a will stand up through probate court, or does a living trust offer better protection?
Yeah, so a will only takes effect after you pass away, which means that the probate court still takes control. So the court validates your will, oversees how your assets are distributed, and charges fees for all of this. Doesn't even include the legal fees charged by the attorneys that your family has to hire. So all of these unnecessary expenses could not only shrink your family's inheritance, but also delay what's left of it. Having a living trust, on the other hand, that takes effect immediately after it's created. So your assets are legally transferred into the trust while you're still alive, and RJP estate planning will help do that, or at least kind of guide you, hold your hand through it. That ensures that they pass directly to the people that you care about after you pass away. So without any of that court, probate involvement, unnecessary expenses. Another major benefit, a living trust protects you if you become incapacitated. So with a trust, you choose the people or person that you want, known as your successor trustee, to manage your assets without needing the court's approval. And a will does not provide that protection. So that's why a living trust not only protects your assets and your loved ones after you pass, but also ensures that your assets are managed by your successor trustee if you become incapacitated and you're no longer able to manage them yourself.
Stephen, back on the subject of wills, what happens if a new will actually resurfaces after an estate was settled in probate court? Does this ever happen?
Yeah, so it happens. I mean, unfortunately, it happens more often than you would like. So if you don't have a trust, say you just have a will, and a new one resurfaces after the settlement probate, and you've gone through that whole mess, your family's, you know, waited and paid legal fees, all of a sudden a new will surfaces, it can tear families apart. So if a new will is discovered after probate settled, the court may have to actually reopen the case and reconsider how the assets are distributed.
So even after probate's over, all the assets have been distributed, and then a new will appears, you saying you have to start all over?
Yeah, so say it's taken a year for that initial probate. That's exactly right. The court must do a thorough investigation. You know, they're looking into, was the new will legally executed? Was it created later than the previous one? Was the new will intentionally hidden or overlooked? Whenever there's disputes about which will is the most valid, probate can drag out again for even more years, leading to costly legal battles between family members. One case, is really sad. We saw two daughters that grew up very close, were once inseparable, and, now they're saying they're never going to speak again. It tore the family apart. But on the other hand, a living trust eliminates this risk, because a trust creates a clear, legally binding plan that bypasses probate court, prevents family disputes. It keeps it black and white, takes the emotion out, protects your assets from unnecessary fees. Unlike a will, a living trust costs just a fraction of what probate settlement could ultimately cost. So since the pandemic, more families, especially younger generations, are realizing the importance of estate planning, but many adult children feel uncomfortable about asking their parents about it. So your kids probably won't walk up and say, "Hey, it's Christmas dinner. Let's talk about what happens when you die, when you pass away. Let's talk about your assets." That's why it's up to you to take action now before it's too late.
That's great insight, Stephen. What's your recommendation for our listeners who don't have an estate plan, or they only have a will?
So yeah, the best step is to work with an estate planning professional to create a personalized living trust. Unlike a will, which still goes through probate, A living trust ensures your assets pass directly to the people you care about without the court delays, legal battles, and necessary costs. So at RJP Estate Planning, they include a living trust plus financial and healthcare power of attorney documents to protect you if you're incapacitated. So once you're an RJP Estate Planning client, we'll provide free settlement support after you pass, which to me is the most important. That's when family members come in, the trustees, they say, hey, we need some handholding. We'll guide your loved ones through the process to receive the inheritance without any of the interruptions or stress. So give RJP Estate Planning a call. So for over 30 years, RJP's helped more than 40,000 Arizona families to protect their assets and secure their loved ones' financial future. So give RJP a call for sure.
So what steps can our listeners take today?
Yeah, so if you're over the age of 60, you can save 65% on a living trust. So we have people on the phone available to take the first 20 callers to get that discount. So along with your living trust, you'll receive a living will, financial power of attorney, medical power of attorney, at no extra cost. It's an entire package, everything you need. So call RJP Estate Planning at 520-441-4523. So that's 520-441-4523. Give us a call now. Be one of the first 20 callers.
That's an incredible offer. So if you're over 60, don't wait. Be one of those first 20 callers and save 65% on a living trust. Plus, get all the other estate planning documents for free as well. Call RJP Estate Planning at 520-441-4523. That's 520-441-4523. Protect your legacy today. Thank you, Stephen, for being with us and sharing your insight.
No problem, Ted. You have a great day, and I'll talk to you probably in a week.
That sounds good, Stephen. We'll talk to you then.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for joining us with The Morning Voice this morning. Next week, I will be out of town, but Matt Neely will flip the sides of the glass that he's on. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to be on the road, but I'm probably going to be listening in, Matt. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you do with the show. You play such a key role in the success of The Morning Voice, and we appreciate you. And I'm glad to see you on this side.
Well, and what a fantastic show! If you missed any of it, David McCumber talked about Proposition 414, talked about the cyber attack they faced. Talked about all sorts of good stuff and his background. So that was very interesting. And an update from Tucson Airport and an update from State Senator Vince Leach. So check out the podcast. We'll have it up in a few minutes.
Thank you for listening and joining us. You've been listening to The Morning Voice on 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Have a great week.
When Tucson is next.